Welcome back to the Inside Lacrosse Pro Lacrosse Podcast. I'm Kyle Devitt, the senior analyst at Inside Lacrosse, and I'm joined, as always, by
Chris Rosenthal, Inside Lacrosse freelance contributor and pro lacrosse analyst.
Yes, this is the PLL Pod Volume 2 after the group stage. We're going to preview all of Tuesday's playoff matchups for you guys and kind of give you our picks for some individual awards, as well as talk about a pressing matter at the end of the podcast. But let's start out with Tuesday's playoff matchups. First game, the number 2 Chrome take on the number 7 Chaos. I think if you go back and watch the game between these two teams from the group stage, you'll see a microcosm of how both these teams not only finished, but exist. So the Chrome came together and fought back with 9 goals in the second half of that game and a ton of individual scorers to win. If you look at the Chaos at any point this season, the only person I trust to score in any game is Curtis Dixon. That's it. Just him. No one else has been consistent enough for me to back them in any way, shape, or form. Now, you can say that's throwing shade, whatever, but we both know what I mean when I say it. And what I mean is the consistency is the thing that makes players great, right? It's not just the ability to do things. It's not just the talent. It's not just the hard work. It's the execution, the excellence of execution. And the Chaos have missed that. If you're going to pick one thing, which I will, one thing, you have all these finishers on your team and no one can finish. It's a problem. And I cannot, I mean, we're not making picks in this game, but I just don't see how the Chrome lose. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's throwing shade even to say that sort of thing, because the Chaos offense has just been a dumpster fire. It's an absolute disaster. They have not cracked double digits in almost literally 1 year.
You threw a 1 year stat out.
There's an anniversary coming up for that sort of thing. Yes, I totally agree. Curtis Dixon, I think he's been playing pretty well. He's got some moves that are kind of floating above the rest of the kind of the errors and the problems that the team is demonstrating. He is someone who is dynamic in his own right. You know, you can just get him the ball in a little bit of space and he can make some things happen on his own. He is their only scorer in the top 20. So any way you want to slice it, they've never really spent more than a few minutes at a time looking like a legitimate threat. They do have moments. They have these sparks where things look great. But it's nothing sustained. Like you said, it's the consistency that really counts, especially, you know, once you get to this level. Now, what the Chrome did to them, and, you know, I think what we might see again is they just kind of, as far as the Chaos defense goes, Chrome just kind of pulled guys out and broke them down individually. And they just, a lot of time, they'd get in just a one-for-one sort of setup. And I think you rarely see it with that frequency at this level. But they were just pulling one guy out and just bullying him from the wings. Somebody gets one guy up top, bullying him down an alley. They would just consistently, I kept noting this every time they were playing, they just kept pulling Tyson Bell out on an island and going after him every time. Like, no matter who the matchup was, you could tell that, you know, Tim Sudan or someone at some point had written on a whiteboard Tyson Bell and just circled the name a bunch of times because they just kept going after him. And as far as the Chaos go, they're going to have to address the Chrome desire to pick on the short sticks differently this time around. You know, maybe they drop one down to Gaudette and bump one up. You know, so you have two poles handling midfielders, but that's going to be another serious issue they're going to face, especially if Jack Rowlett is out for the entirety of this game. You know, we saw him miss some time in the last game, and, you know, he's on the injury report right now. You know, I think they had him sort of I don't know if the word concussion was explicitly stated, but whatever they say, you know, brain injury protocol or something like that. So he's clearly got some tests to pass before he's back on the field. So we will see if he's going to be able to get out there and contribute. If not, that is going to be a serious loss for a team that's pretty short on pole depth as is.
I think legally, if you say concussion and the guy plays, you're in trouble.
Right.
That's kind of changed now. I think that word is almost like a dirty word now. So,
right.
You know, brain injury protocol, however you want to slice it. It's, if you have a concussion and you get diagnosed with a concussion, you shouldn't play for a week. Like, trust me, I've had 9. I can't believe I can talk. Like, it's a serious thing. It's no joke, but that's a great point to make. Noble's going to have to step up and play more minutes. I mean, really, you got to look at Tommy Kelly in this game too, because Connor Farrell kind of worked him over in the last matchup. And I don't know what happened. I think so. I've heard people talk about TK just like dropping weight and getting his hand speed and all that stuff. His wings are not helping him out to get the ball. He's winning clamps, but he's not pulling the ball out in time. He's trying to win it to himself. And I think sometimes when players go up or down in weight because they think it's the right move, it's sometimes the wrong move. Because if you drop weight as you get older, which, by the way, if you want to maintain your career as a professional athlete, like, losing weight is better because it's less stress on your joints. If you can kind of stay in an area of like 10 to 20 pounds of where your peak performance was, right? I don't know if being a face-off guy is great to lose weight at. Because, like, wouldn't you want a ton of power? Wouldn't you want, like, pushing guys out and boxing guys out and throwing a hip into someone's, like, other hip? You know, just boxing dudes out and pushing balls everywhere? Like, I feel like that's a big part of the game. And I'm not saying that's the only reason. Whatever. I'm not giving excuses. I'm just saying, and his wing play has – his wings, not great. Just flat out not great. And the chrome wings actually are great. So I think those are kind of the areas that we're watching is the offense of the chaos, the offense of the chrome, if there's adjustments defensively, and, you know, what happens at the faceoff X. Let's move on to our next game, the number 4 seed Redwoods against the 5 seed Water Dogs. I think this could be the most fun game of the three. You have two offenses that have gone scoreless for long stretches of this tournament, despite having lots of possessions and lots of scoring chances. So with that in mind, I'm going to say the key to this entire game is whichever team can just dial in their finishing. That sort of sounds like what I'm saying is the team that scores more goals will win.
Right.
A little more nuanced than that. These teams both have team shooting percentages under 25%. That's not good. That's not horrible, but it's not what one would call prolific. And the Redwoods goal total is skewed because they have 9 two-pointers. 9. Do you really think the Redwoods can rely on sticking 2 to 3 two-pointers a game in the playoffs now that everyone knows that's what they're going to try and do? Because I don't. One last stat I'm going to throw at you. Sergio Perkovic has 6 two-pointers. Guess how many regular goals, quote-unquote, he has.
How many?
1. 1. He's 1 for 18.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Again, we're not here to, like, make picks. We're just kind of, like, pointing out things that maybe are something to watch in the game to make the game more interesting. I think both of these, like, face-off units are wildly uninteresting. does that mean, like, they don't stick out, right? Like, Withers has had a couple moments, right? And Simoneau's had a couple moments. But I think that, by and large, it's just like a rock fight. And I love rock fights. We've had a couple in this group stage. I enjoy a good rock fight as long as that's what it is. If you know, if you're going to a bar that you know that bar has fights at it, and you get into a fight, you knew what you were getting.
Right.
So don't go into this game thinking you're going to get 30 goals. Just do not, because you will be disappointed. You'll be very disappointed. What are your thoughts on this matchup?
So I will say about the face-off battle, the noteworthy element to me is just how bad the Redwoods have been at the face-off. And if that is something that they can kind of, you know, overcome in this situation. Peyton Smith's at 38%. I don't know if he's going to be the number one. I feel like it's probably been leaning towards him kind of starting to get more of the lion's share and, you know, less Greg Fiskalian. Maybe, just maybe, there might be something that, you know, Nat St. Laurent wants to try out with Fiskalian having some experience against Semenoe from their kind of previous years having gone against each other, or, you know, some sort of familiarity that he may not have, you know, that Peyton Smith being a rookie might not be able to bring to the table against those other two. But that is a place where I think the Redwoods might have to seriously work to overcome a little bit. That being said, you mentioned the two-pointer situation. And, yeah, it is definitely something where we haven't really been able to bank on two-pointers being a consistent thing. That said, what I was wondering about this game, if Matt DeLuca gets the start for the Water Dogs, I am curious as to how being 6'6" affects the two-point bouncers that people are embracing a lot right around now. Like, if that affects it at all, and if he's gotten used to seeing them in his limited time as a starting goalie or as a goalie getting, you know, the bulk of the share. My thinking behind this is, if you are that large, disclaimer, I am not.
No.
Not at all. Never been accused of being 6'6". Thinking is maybe if you get the high arc bouncer, you drop, and then is it tougher for someone at that height to get back up there? I think it also depends on if you are tall by way of the leg versus by way of the arms. You know what I mean? Like if you're like a Jack Skellington sort of situation.
Yeah, like if you're like have a simian build.
Right.
I feel like you're taking shots at me right now, and I don't know. I don't really enjoy it. I'm not going to lie to you.
I thought you were going to say I was taking shots at Matt DeLuca, and I was like, I do not know his specific structure. I do not know if he's more arm or leg.
I would say leg. I'm comfortable saying he's more leg.
Yeah. I don't know. I am in the realm of the two-point game, I am curious to see them try to put at least a couple on him just to see how he, in fact, handles it. They were going, like, just no excuses top shelf against Jack and Cannon. That's how Miles Jones got his. It was just stick side high. I feel like being that tall, they will be afraid of even trying that against DeLuca.
Well,
I mean, Concannon is not small. Don't get me wrong.
No, but Concannon's a dropper. And everyone knows Concannon's a dropper. So if you can get him to, like, if you fool him with your stick location, like, he will react. Like, he's not a guesser. Like, it's not a – I was actually saying this on Twitter, and I think John Paul, former coach of the Atlas, was like, oh, no, yeah, like, he's a dropper, but he's, like, really good. And I was like, oh, yeah, no, I don't mean it in a bad way. It's just a style of goalie play where guys will drop because a lot of shots are supposed to go low, and then if they go high, you can get it with your stick.
Right.
So it's not, like, a pejorative term. It's just kind of, like, a way to describe. I don't think DeLuca plays like that. DeLuca is much more a – like side to side guy where he moves with his stick and he mirrors really well. But I think that if you're talking about shot location, the Redwoods are not the team that cares about shot location. I'm just going to be real with you. I have no evidence in the four games that they care where they're shooting at all, except for bouncers on twos. That is the only evidence I have. Everything else is wild. Shots all over the place.
Well, I will say this, their league low 19% shooting percentage backs up that assessment.
Yes. What did you think of kind of the midfield here?
That is probably the part I'm most interested in seeing, especially if we still don't get Matt Cavanaugh back to full speed. And he's been, you know, he had like a back issue that's been keeping him out and probably keeping him a little handcuffed even when he was playing. So I'm really interested in seeing the midfield battle. You know, you've got Zach Currier, back and healthy, you know, ripping corner for the overtime win. You're going to have him back in there. Brent Adams, Pat Harbison has been offensively quiet, but I feel like that kind of position, you really just can get one at any given time. Same sort of situation with Jack Neer or McClancy over for the Water Dogs. The Water Dogs don't really have a lot of put the team on my back sort of guys right now, yeah. At least in this tournament. It's more been people chipping in a goal or two here and there. You know what I mean? Like, is this going to be a Ben McIntosh game? We don't know. Maybe it is. Maybe it won't be. Like, they have guys who just do, like, so much is made of them being within the flow of their weird sort of nebulous offense that you don't really have a lot where it's like, okay, we're going to dump it down to X and everybody get out of his way. You know? So I think a lot is going to be settled between the arcs with some of those guys. Maybe somebody emerges from those lines.
Yeah, that's kind of my point with both these teams, right? Where the offenses are fragmented. They're very, like, they have moments, right, where you see, like, Kieran McArdle was running the show for one of those games, and, like, it looked like, okay, we're turning the corner, we're going to do it. And then, like, they blew a timeout call, you know, like, or something like that, and just, like, something really stupid. Or, like, they threw the ball away twice at the end of the game against – actually, pick any team. I'm pretty sure they did that twice at the end of every game they've played, even the one they won.
Yeah.
They probably shouldn't have won.
They tried.
I mean, listen, better lucky than good. But the problem that I see with them is actually kind of the opposite. Like, they're all younger, hungry players, but they all kind of play the same way, which is like to get to their spots. But a lot of them have the same spot, which is kind of what the Redwoods do. But, like, at least the Redwoods have, like, a ton of lefties that are comfortable over the field. They have very versatile veteran leadership. I think with, you know, especially with the midfield, just like you're saying, like, who is going to make that impact? And obviously, like, if you and I were to pick a guy, we'd probably just pick Zach Currier and just be like, he's the best midfielder in this game. And I have no problem saying that. So I'm probably going to pick him to make the biggest impact. In this scenario, especially.
Plus, we know what Zach Currier does when, you know, it's tournament time. He just wins a lot.
Yes.
So if there is any sort of, you know, intangible thing, you got to give Zach Currier some sort of points. Like, you know, if it's going to be a close game or something like that, I would give the edge to this guy who just has a flair for winning championships.
Got to crank it up. All right. Speaking of cranking things up, the third game, another rematch. The third seed Archers versus the sixth seed Atlas. I don't see how this game goes down the same way that the first one went. And by that, I mean, I expect the Archers to score a lot more in transition, like they did for big chunks of the Whipsnakes game before they kind of got run over there in the second half. I think the Archers are going to attack matchups with better two-man big littles behind the net. I think the Atlas have literally one help defender the whole time, and his name is Kay Van Ramphorst. Everyone else seems to be just doing whatever they want, and that's why they get beat, because they keep getting beat one-on-one, and then if it's not on Van Ramphorst's side to slide, no one slides. They're all cover guys. All the poles are quote-unquote cover guys, but you need to do more than cover to be a successful long pole in the PLL. I also think the Atlas have been extremely lucky to manufacture possessions with their ride, because either their ride is really just keeping two mids on lock and jumping lazy ball carriers, or the ball is just like rolling to an attackman and it's easy. Because that attack isn't doing much other than occasionally jogging to spots. Like, it's not even a drop ride. Like, the Archers run a drop ride, right? It's great. It's beautiful. It limits, like, it makes you make another pass or at least run past two guys. The Atlas ride is like zonal marking ball cluster. It's like, what side is the ball on? All right, it's just kind of like cluster that up, make sure that they don't get the easy pass. And it's not even a run. It's just kind of like I'm in my zone. Is anyone around me? No? Okay, well, they have to pass it across the field because I stand here. You know, I hate it. I watch it on tape and I'm like, what is this? I'm angry. And it creates turnovers, right? Like, I don't, it shouldn't. I'm frustrated watching tape on this team because, like, they're being gifted possessions. I personally feel the Archers have to play badly for the Atlas to win. And I just don't see it happening. What about you?
Yeah, no, I agree. I haven't seen anything from either of these teams that would make me think that the Archers are going to, are likely candidates to drop this one, or that the Atlas will pull it off. You know, I mean, the Atlas, like, just on a number sort of standpoint, just littered with shooting problems left and right. Just almost an entire team-wide collective slump. Like, Connor Bucic is shooting 8%, Paul Reed 6%. Even Rob Pinnell is shooting 13%. You know, he's getting some assists and things, but, like, those are not great numbers. And it's not even being not great if so many people are doing that. You know, they're just, you know, I think what Ryan Brown had the game, I think he was 1 for 11, if I'm not mistaken, that a while ago. It's just everyone's ice cold. And, you know, like, you can't really cross your fingers for so long and just hope everything pans out. You know, I think a lot of predictions, you know, pregame analysis comes down to stuff like, well, you know, once they figure it all out, right? Or, like, once things get working, you know, we've seen it before. So once that comes back around, and basically what that comes down to is, like, once they're different people than what we're currently seeing them be, you know, but there's no guarantee that that happens. And there's definitely no guarantee that it happens this game. And this isn't a good defense to expect your bounce back against.
No.
You know, these are very competent goalies, very competent defenses, very aggressive, you know, hard-hitting, physical, short-stick defensive midfielders. There isn't really anywhere on that side of the ball. I mean, somebody's going against Scott Ratliff. We talked about him last time. This isn't really a good defense to go against when you're just figuring things out. So I don't think that bodes well for this offense. And I just think the defense as well, like we saw against these guys last time, it's, you know, you get Schreiber, you get Amen, you get Holman. Maybe, you know, we haven't seen him as much as we were used to seeing him last year or whatever, but you still have somebody like Will Manny, who's a threat, and, you know, needs no time once he catches the ball to put it away. It's a lot to ask of Jack and Cannon. And, they put him in some tough situations the last time they faced each other. But, you know, it's just a lot to ask of one guy. Let me ask you this question because I was just thinking about this.
Yes.
I don't take any glee in this because, as far as I know, he's a nice guy. I've spoken to him a few times. He was nice. He's a guest on our podcast back when we used to have guests.
When they would come on.
Right, back when we used to have them. And maybe this is why they don't come on anymore.
Probably not.
Rob Pinnell, how do you think this season, like, how do you think he is dealing with what this is? You know, obviously, like, last year, he wanted to join up. You know, everybody's over here having a great time. He comes over, falls to the third overall spot. You know, Atlas picks him up. Awesome. He's going back with all the Team USA guys. Just like, how do you think he's possibly processing that, like, this is just the exact opposite of how he imagined this would go, right?
I think it's still better than the situation he came from.
Sure.
So if you're comparing, I think you can't do that without acknowledging that it's still better than yelling at Dylan Malloy to get out of the way. Right? It's still better than that. It's still better than playing with an entire team full of attackmen, trying to play midfield, trying to play lacrosse. So I think in that sense, it's better. I think and this is kind of what I was talking about in the previous podcast. Like, you have all these great defenders and all these great attackmen. Eventually, the scale tips, right? Like, yes, lacrosse favors offense. Lacrosse favors scoring. That's why it's incredible to watch. And so much, like, artistry goes into scoring. But the dark arts, playing defense. And playing defense the right way, team defense, we're talking, you know, comboing your checks, popping out to the right spots on a clear, hedging, delivering the hit when you need to hit, and even if getting the penalty, playing man down defense. Like, the level of play as far as that goes defensively is at an all-time high. And that sounds crazy because you have teams that like have bad team defenses, but the teams that are good and dialed in, the Whipsnakes are, that might be the best defense ever. Like, I don't know if that's, if it's too soon and then they get beat and I look real stupid in like 3 days. Cool. I don't care. I think it might be the best and most talented overall defense ever assembled at the pro level.
Yeah, there are just no cracks in that wall. Like, you know what I mean? There's no one spot where you really can just say, okay, let's just pick on this spot and we'll be okay.
Right. But going back to your point, right, with Rob Pinnell, Rob is seeing different looks and Rob is not playing his kind of normal style. He's not trying to get to 5-5 as much. You see him kind of, I feel like the plan is for him to be a distributor, for him to control the game and to hit guys that are wide open. And by the way, he has done that. It's not his fault that his teammates are missing shots at a almost historic rate. Honestly, like, he is doing a good job of distributing the ball. He could probably have 10 more assists than he has. No joke. 10. Honestly, 10. That being said, he is kind of racking up turnovers quietly, kind of in the corner, stacking up dominoes, getting turnovers, right? That's happening. That's also always happened. You know, it's not like he had a 3-1 assist to turnover ratio his whole career. That's not how it works. When you go against the number one defenseman in any league, that's not how it works, but especially this league. So I think that's kind of, it's an adjustment period, right? He's only had 4 games. We could see, I don't think that like he's, I hate saying this, this term is like so lazy, but people are like, oh, Rob Pinnell's washed. Like, shut up. You have no idea what you're talking about. Honestly, if you've watched the games, like, yeah, he's not shooting great. He's never shot great. If he can't get to his spot, he's not going to shoot great. Period. End of story. But he does everything else. He does something that almost no one else except for Rambo does, where he draws the defense and then he backs up.
Right.
And he waits to see what the next move is. And he looks for the two. He looks for the two slide. And Lord help you if you don't have a two slide. Because that's the feed. It's not the first guy that's sliding, right? It's the second guy behind the two, because the one slide's, like I said, with good defense, the one slide's already there, hedging, ready, blocking your view, trying to mess up your rhythm. The two slide is what he feeds on. And against bad defenses, that's what he does. But I think you're seeing him kind of have to, you know, find that next gear to get to 5-5 and make people respect him as more than just a feeder. And respect him as a scorer. So I would not be surprised if Rob Pinnell went off for 6 points. I wouldn't. I also think Eric Law, the ghost, is due for a reappearance here. Another haunting is possible. Anytime Eric Law is on your team, he can haunt your soul. So maybe get ready for that. And maybe I was being too flip, perhaps. I've been known to be flip.
Stranger things have happened.
Yes. Any other thoughts before we move on to the next topic?
No, let's do it.
All right. These are our PLL player awards for the group stage, which is like a halfway award before the playoffs, I guess. I don't think these will be final awards. Let's start with the most prestigious, the MVP. Chris, why don't you go first?
For the MVP, I'm going with Joe Nardella, face-off man for the Whipsnakes.
Okay.
My thinking behind that is there is nobody in the Premier Lacrosse League who has been more dominant at what they do, especially when compared with their, you know, contemporaries at their position, than Joe Nardella. 75% through group play, whereas the second best full-time non-sharing at the position draw man was Connor Farrell, and he is at 56%. So you really see just the difference you're getting with Nardella in that regard. Plus, you got to add the 3 goals and an assist that he's got in 4 games, which is pretty good. And you also have somebody who, like, the defenses need to account for until he leaves the field, which is just, you know, another way that keeps them distracted. You have to keep their slides more honest. If he, you know, if he brings the ball up, it takes him no time to get into a shooting position. You know, by the time he wins it and pushes it forward, it looks like it's about 3 steps before he's ready to shoot. You got to get like an early slide over to him. He's demonstrated that he needs it, which allows him to just move the ball very quickly. I mean, it just sets off a chain reaction. If he gets rid of that ball quickly and he gets off quickly, then, you know, you get the substitution advantage. Basically, he's doing stuff that just opens up so much more opportunity for these whip snakes, especially they put one in and then they can go on these runs and, you know, really start to put their opponents away. You know, like, who knows if these games pan out exactly the same way if Joe Nardella is just pretty good. So
yeah.
That being said, you know, if he's at 56%, you know, like, are they putting the archers away in such a fashion if they don't get to play any sort of make it take it ball the rate at which they're doing it? We will never have to know because they have Joe Nardella.
We promise that the rest of this list won't be as boring, but my pick is also Joe Nardella. My favorite clip that's happened was against the Archers. They had Nardella mic'd up, and he's getting ready to draw. And he goes from – his voice changes. It goes – like he's talking to Boyle through the helmet mic. And he's just like, oh, I'm going to take this face off right now. And I'm just like, yeah, I love it. That is, oh, I love that. I loved that so much. Like, you guys can keep your That Speed Boy. You can keep that. I want angry, growling Joe Nardella, like, in the mic constantly. It is incredible. And, like, I love when they mic up the face off guy because there's always, like, the grunts. Just like,
right.
This is funny to me. I don't know. He's a dominant player. He's my MVP. You guys can throw points at me, whatever. We'll have awards for those people later, but MVP is most valuable player, and it's Joe Nardella. I just don't think you can argue it. Let's move on to goalie. I'm going to go first this time, and I am picking John Galloway. He of the Gallosants. Even though he really only had like a couple down years the last couple of years. It's okay. Like, he knows it. He played behind a, I'm just going to say, atrocious defense last year. I'm just going to say it.
That's fair.
It's a lot of hedging. It's a lot of people going back and being like, oh, well, the Chrome or, you know, and I'm like, no, they're bad. Actually bad. This season, saving 59%, 11.2 goals against average. The reason John Galloway is valuable is because he throws the best outlets in lacrosse. In lacrosse, period. Like, I don't think it's close. Maybe Phipps. But, like, Phipps doesn't throw them quicker. Like, he throws them longer. But Galloway throws everything. Like, the ball is up and out faster than anyone else. Gittleman will run the ball out, right? Like, he's faster at that, and he has the instinct to do that. But Galloway, save, balls up and out, should be a break like half the time. So he's my goalie of the year so far. What about you?
First of all, I do agree. John Galloway is the best clearing goalie I have heard of all time. I'm not going to say that because I haven't watched lacrosse for, you know, 40 years or something like that. But best of my viewing lifetime. He's also, in my opinion, I do think he's probably tied with Phipps in this regard, best at intercepting passes around his crease.
Yeah, he's pretty good at that. Yeah.
He will definitely snag a possession or two, kills people on extra man sometimes, that sort of thing. So shout out to him for that.
Yep.
My pick is Blaze Rudin. So now, does get tough to me because this is a situation where Kyle Burnmore just isn't going to get the votes, I think. And he is most successful, but through no fault of his own, he has seen 10 more shots total than Blaze Reardon has saved.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
It's a great stat.
Poor Blaze. You know, the team record is really sticking it to him in this regard. He's had a very tough season from a PR perspective. You know, he starts off with that rough outing that we're all going to talk about forever because of Matt Gaudette doing all the chirping. He's on the end of that. And it wasn't a great performance by Blazer. And he was like cool admitting that. He had been interviewed later. He was like, hey, I've been lit up before. I'm going to get lit up again. It happens. That was like the day after that game happened. But then, you know, he also has that overtime battle against the Redwoods, you know, where after Tim Trautner comes up with that huge save. But then he's on the losing end of that too. So like that doesn't even go well with him, even though he had like 20 something stops. And then finally, you know, like we've said, you know, his team just can't score goals. But he is leading the league in saves and save percentage. So I think that is both, you know, those are both things that can definitely be helped if you're just going like number wise. And in that game against Toronto, I just mentioned, he did have 8 more stops than him that game alone, and he stopped 77% on that night. So even when he was coming up on the losing side, he was still shining individually. So I think the individual performance of him gets this individual award.
Chris, why did I not pick Blaze Reardon?
Why?
Because his team's 0-4. Sorry.
Well, I would counter with this. Imagine if he wasn't the best goalie.
0-4.
Right. They'd be a bigger 0-4.
Oh, man. It might just be like you'd have to change the font when you put the stat up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Let's go to defensive player of the group period. Who you got?
Defensive player, I'm going with Eddie Glazner of the Redwoods. And I think one of the reasons why I went with Glazner here is this season he's had to do so many different things. And I think he's kind of thrived in all the situations he's been thrown into. I think kind of the go-to for him, especially last year, I think he kind of gained attention due to, you know, the whole mic'd up aspect of the PLL. You know, he started really getting acknowledged for his, you know, field general stuff, making sure everybody in the defense knows where they're supposed to be, when they're supposed to be there. But this year, I think he's also kind of stood out more as having to be a cover man. Like, for example, like Garrett Eppel has to sit a game against the Chaos. Everybody else's role changes. And so Glazner draws the matchup against Connor Fields, which I don't think would have been his matchup if Eppel was still in the game. Fields finishes with one goal. Only gets 3 shots off. When Garrett Eppel does come back, they have him in their latest game kind of running all over, not just at close, which I think kind of speaks to Glazner's flexibility even more, that they were comfortable letting him just kind of go out there and hold down the fort at the close spot. Whereas last year, I think when they had to kind of reassemble their defense, Matt Landis last year missed at least a couple of games with a lower body injury, if I remember correctly. Then they kind of had to accommodate for that, you know, bring somebody else down from LSM and play a little close. And it didn't work out as smoothly as it did this year with Glazner being able to step up his game. So I would give him the acknowledgement. But I do think there's been a bunch of really solid individual defensive performances.
My pick is Matt Dunn. And
he's one.
If you just look at stats, that pick is terrible. 2 caused turnovers, 3 ground balls. You say to yourself, Kyle, how can you pick this man? He does not have the stats. Well, friend, this is why we watch games. Matt Dunn is a beast. He is the best number one defenseman in the league. He guards the opposition's best player. He makes their life difficult the entire time they are on the field. That is what a good defenseman does. He's also pretty sound. He actually has some, like, I think three really nice snags off of terrible outlets to him. Like, he caught one by his ankles. I was like, oh, not done. Handles. You know, it's not, he's multifaceted. He plays help defense. He's there in the scrums all the time. He's not scared to deal a hit. He throws hammer checks. He combos his checks. He uses V-holds. He holds GLE. He bullies people. He bullies number one attackmen in the PLL. To me, that makes you the best defenseman. That is why every single person that like watches any defense whatsoever always talks about Tucker Durkin. Except Matt Dunn is Tucker Durkin now. He is the captain now. Look at him. He is the captain. That is a change of the torch that we did not see visual confirmation from. But I will tell you that I have seen it on the field, and he's easily my pick for the best defenseman in the league. Let's go to offensive player. I'm going to take this one first. Obviously, for me, it's Matt Rambo. 6 goals, 15 assists. Broke the regular season record, or all records. All records for points in a game with 10. 8 assists against the Archers, against a really good defense. He played them like a fiddle, man. Like, he was, they were marionettes, and he was just making them dance, you know? And it's so funny because the way he does it is so different from the guy we were just talking about. He's so different from Pinnell, right? Mm-hmm. Where you can tell Matt Rambo wants to get the ball to this person in this spot. And the thing that goes through his head, whether he consciously thinks about it or not, is how do I do that? And he does different thing. Like, he changes his approach. He doesn't just like throw his body in, roll back, step back, throw a pass, right? He doesn't have a, he's unpredictable. He doesn't have a cadence. Right. So it makes him harder to guard, because if you guard him as a feeder, you give him space. And if you give him space, he smashes into your chest with his shoulder and shoots and scores. So you can't give him space. But if you play him close up, he'll step back and make you come out and play him at GLE. He'll get ahead of steam, and then he'll get past you again, and he'll either shoot and score or step back and make a perfect feed. And that's why, I mean, spoilers for Chris's pick. That's why Chris's pick has his goals. It's because of Matt Rambo. You know what I mean? Like, he still has to put it away. That's a skill. I'm not knocking that whatsoever. But Rambo is easily the best offensive player, and it's not just because of that one game. It's because of the other games, and sometimes it takes him a little while, or the matchup isn't right, or he has to kind of get started off a pick, right? Like, sometimes he just needs – we all need a little something sometimes. We all need coffee in the morning. Matt Rambo needs a pick set at G League. That's what that man needs sometimes, and I'm here for it. I'm all about it. I love watching it. Chris, who is your offensive player?
My offensive player was Zed Williams. I mean, basically, I just want to start with, so 17 points overall, at least a hat trick in every game of his summer. Just a consistent nightmare to stay with, you know, in off ball work, to stay on for, you know, on ball work. We have seen him beating people in all sorts of manners. Of, you know, top side rolls, inside rolls, splits, whatever, jump shots, whatever. He's pulling every sort of trick out of his bag. You know, we've seen him in college, and we've seen him in the pros, you know, playing with the Cannons, demonstrating, obviously, this is someone with a strong prowess for offense. But we are seeing Zed Williams out of his mind this particular summer. He is just, I don't know if it's a comfort thing. Maybe he's just really, you know, enjoying the role he has with the team. I don't know if you can pinpoint one thing. Sometimes stuff just clicks. I don't know what it is, but he is just balling out of his mind right now. And he's doing it with a shooting percentage that is definitely, as far as someone who is scoring this much, I mean, his shooting percentage is like 36%, 37%, which is, as far as, you know, consistent scorers go, it is really, really amongst the top of them. So it's not like he is, you know, it's not like he is taking shots that are, you know, screwing the rest of his team because they don't work or anything like that. He is getting his within the confines of the offense. And, you know, we've seen that they're continuing to thrive. Especially, you know, we saw, like you just mentioned, Rambo, he's doing great. The team's doing great. I think the offensive player is going to have to come from someone whose team is beating everybody else. So if they don't give it to Rambo, I certainly think they'll give it to Zed.
All right, our next award, we don't know how PLL is going to do this, so we're going to do it our own way. This is the Newcomer Award, not the Rookie Award, the Newcomer Award to the PLL. Chris, who you got?
So I got this guy, Zed Williams. And
Heard of him.
You got to check out this Zed Williams guy. He's been doing some very impressive things this summer. I'm not going to waste any time by saying more things about the guy I just said stuff about. But he's really good at offense and I think is the best newcomer.
My pick for newcomer is Christian Mazzone, the pride of Rutgers. He of Short King fame, 8 goals, playing a midfield role that really was, I want to say, popularized by guys like TJ Camizio, even though that's not Camizio's role this year on the Whipsnakes, which is a true transition midfielder where he'll stay on and play a little defense, but what he's really there for is the break, right? He lives off the break, and he's done incredible things off the break. You know, like you see midfielders come into this league in particular, and they struggle, man. Like, it's hard. You don't get that speed right away, you are in trouble. If you can't hang with feet with every single person, you can't run shoulder to shoulder, you can't throw a hard check, you can't get a timely ground ball, you're going to find yourself on the bench. And Christian Mazzone has done all of those things and more, and he's been rewarded with more and more playing time, a larger role in the offense and the defense. He's a threat everywhere. I've written a lot about Christian Mazzone, man. I don't know why my bona fides got tested on Twitter, but maybe you're just not reading it. But I've loved his game for many a year, so I'm happy to give him the newcomer award. True rookie, which is, I think, what, 5 players are eligible for this award?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, no brainer though. Granny Matt, right? I'll let you elucidate on Grant Amet though. This is because we both picked him, so I'll let you kind of explain that out.
Right. So I think if they are going to split it up, and honestly, maybe if they don't, between rookies and newcomers, I mean, yeah, Grant Amet. What can you say? So you got to find a guy who's going to be comfortable running this offense at least shoulder to shoulder with perhaps the best player in the game, right? And some of the best offensive weapons around. And he's going to have to join this locker room that, you know, some of these guys have been together for just a couple years. You know, some of them go back many years. Like, you know, you're looking at like, how long have Schreiber and Holman been playing together, you know? And then you're going to have this kid pop up from college, getting all this attention, first round overall pick. And he's going to, in some cases, when he isn't shoulder to shoulder with guys like Schreiber, he's going to be the leader on that offense. That is a heavy load to dump on somebody who probably, you know, is just starting to learn everybody's name, you know, starting to learn how they like to cut and things like that. And this whole team that has been together, he jumps right in and takes charge and is doing pretty much everything he could possibly think to ask of an offensive quarterback. He's doing it. He's calling his own number. He's making absurd passes, making intelligent plays, like as the shot clock's winding down. And that's something that, you know, as a rookie, you can understand, I thought maybe I had a few more seconds. I'm not used to playing this shot clock, you know? But even that sort of stuff, even the little things like that, he is excelling in. There's really not much more I think they could have asked him to do. And so I think that's why you give it to him.
Yeah, I completely agree. And that is also why I picked him. I think he's a star already. And like his ceiling is not scalable right now, which I don't remember the last player I thought that about while I was watching them as a rookie. I can't remember. It might be Rabel. Like, that sounds crazy, but like thinking about it, like watching them, yeah, just the ceiling, like the absolute apex. I can't scale it, frame it. So if that's the highest compliment I ever pay a player, like, sure, I'm okay with it. Yep. I'm okay, like, throwing the rap away. I don't care. It's amazing. I love watching him play. Last award, coach. Who you got?
For the coach, I have Jim Stagnita, also of the old Whip Snakes. So now, here's the thing. If we are talking performance since entering the bubble, I don't think it goes to Stagnita, and that's not a shot at Stagnita. I just think it goes to another guy, and I do know you're picking the other guy, so I'll leave that blank. That said, if you were talking about coaching from, you know, the end of last year and having to do everything that a league like this asks of a coach, you know, all the off-field stuff, if that gets any sort of partial credit thrown into the coach award, I think he takes it.
Yeah.
Just because, like, he had to successfully navigate this expansion draft. And, you know, it might seem obvious now, having seen their success throughout this tournament, but, you know, he has to make that call where he's going to keep everybody on one half, and he has to find a way to be comfortable losing however many, you know, he has to be okay saying goodbye to Connor Kelly, Ben Reeves, you know, Drew Snyder. All of these players might disappear, and they did. He's got to figure a way to get past that. And then, you know, he has to get some credit for even grabbing Zed Williams fifth. Granted, it's partially luck that he was there, but he certainly didn't have to take him. So I got to give him some credit for doing that. And then taking this offense that looked very different from the year before, thanks to all the reshuffled cast of characters, and then leaving group play as the last undefeated team, last man standing, I do have to give him some credit for the whole thing. So that's why he wins my award for Coach of the Year.
Yeah, those are all great answers. But I think a lot of people, including myself, think it's Tim Sudan, the Cro-Mag coach, completely rebuilt this team from players that, listen, I don't care how big of a Chrome fan you were or are, you had no idea who half these players were. Like, don't lie to yourself. Don't sit there and go, oh, no, I knew that. No, you didn't. You did not. It's okay. It's okay. It's actually our job to tell you who they are. So that's probably our fault that you didn't know that. But I know how he works. I know, you know, Jacques Monty, his assistant coach, that longtime partnership. They know what they're doing. They know how to build. I think actually the key acquisition there is Mike Manley. Pulling him back in for this run, I think, has helped them a lot. But I also think Reese Eddy has been incredible. Duggan has been incredible. The D-mids, all the D-mids have been incredible. I mean, I don't even know how to single anyone out for praise. It's just been – the reason he's the coach of the year isn't because his team's 3-1. It's because he completely changed the culture of the team into a winning culture with players that trust him and trust the systems he runs and like him. Like, people like him. Do you know what I mean? Like, there are coaches that get the best out of you, and they can rattle you, and they can, you know, shake the trees, fire and brimstone coaches, right? And then there are coaches that are like, they find like a little nerve with you, and they are a little string that they can pluck, and they get the best out of you by doing that. And whether it's needling you, making fun of you, or building you back up, or pulling you aside and telling you, like, that you're doing a great job. Like, that's Tim Sudan. So he's my coach of the group stage. I think he might end up being coach of the year anyway, just because of everything that happens. But anything else to say with these awards before we move on?
No, just say I would certainly not be mad at any of these picks. A lot of people have are worthy of the praise. I think that's a good reason why we didn't like sit down and discuss these, you know, get some different answers at them. Because, like, I mean, no, if Rambo wins anything, no, I'm not complaining about that. Same with Sudan or Stagnita. Like, yeah, if Sudan wins, I'm definitely in agreement. Like, yeah, that's a great pick, you know, just really turn that team around. Shout out Donnie Moss, I think fit in really well with him coming back over with Sudan, and Eli Salama, whose long stick play I think was a big contribution as well. That's all I got.
All right, let's touch on another topic, and it's probably not the one you think it is, because we're not really here to talk about Twitter fights. We just start and end those. I want to bring this up. We want to bring this up because, you know, we haven't seen enough media people talk about it publicly. And I'm going to pull back the curtain a little bit here for you guys. Lacrosse media, it's small. It's very, very small. As in, we all know each other. If one of us knows a secret, it won't be very long until we all know the secret. That's kind of how this works. And, you know, we actually also don't hate each other like it seems like we do on Twitter. That is straight up kabuki theater stuff for followers and fans. It's for fun. We don't actually, you know, there's no enemies here, right? We all love pro lacrosse, college lacrosse. We all love it so much that we sacrifice to cover it. And I have to say, I feel like we've kind of let you guys down. We've been talking about, or we haven't been talking enough about one thing for a very long time, and that's the Black Lives Matter movement and the patches that are, or rather aren't, on the chests of PLL players. If you recall the announcement by the PLL regarding said patches, another accoutrement, as it was presented, it was presented as an option for players. And the vast majority of PLL players have taken up that option to simply show support. However, some players have not taken that option. A list of players is circulating. We have it. So we're going to read it. This is a list of players that are not wearing BLM patches. Archers, Brendan Fowler, Stephen Kelly. Atlas, Jack Kincannon, Kyle Hartzell. Chaos, Sergio Salcido, Dan Coates, Jake Ficarro, Troy Ray, Matt Reese, Tommy Kelly. On the Chrome, Connor Farrell, Mike Manley, Jesse Bernhardt, and Brendan Kavanaugh. On the Redwoods, Garrett Upple. On the Water Dogs, Andy Copeland does not have a BLM patch. The Lip Snakes, Jake Bernhardt, Joe LoCascio, Michael Earhart, Brett Schmidt, Jacob Stover, Jeremy Sieverts, and Kyle Bernlohr. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to you, Rosie.
I got a list sent to me actually a while back, and I didn't really have a desire to go tweet it or something and tell everyone that people weren't doing it, because like I think if you watch the games and you care, like if you were watching with an eye for that sort of thing, I think it's easy to tell who was and wasn't doing it. Personally, I tweeted out. Everybody follows me on Twitter. You might have seen this a couple days ago or about a week ago or something. Time has no meaning during the PLL tournament. I tweeted that Garrett Upple wasn't wearing one. And I did that in contrast with a photo where he was previously wearing one, because he was wearing one in one photo and not in another. So I thought that was weird. I didn't know what would make one have it in one place and not have it in another. If it's your choice, right? If the league designates that it's your choice, why wouldn't you just not wear it or just wear it? I don't know why you would be on record with both. So, but yeah, so like, and then there were other people who didn't have it on the field, and those people didn't have it in the pictures, which made the whole thing just look strange to me. I will say that basically the response to that was kind of two camps. There were some people who wanted to go at him about it, you know, and say, you know, what's your problem, you know, and so forth. And then there are some people who wanted to go at me saying, what's your problem? You know, let the man have his own opinion. Don't bring politics into it or whatnot. And to which I would counter that is his opinion. I like wearing patches for 24 hours, but no more than 24 hours. Because if that's not the opinion he's making, then I'm not really talking about his opinion. I was just, again, pointing out the oddity of having it and not having it. Basically, so I think as far as the league goes, I think the main strategy was to get through the whole, I don't want to downplay it by calling it just a thing, but I think the whole thing without making waves, you know what I mean? Like they have access to all the media avenues they could possibly want to pursue, right? You know what I mean? They could do a video about this sort of thing. They could have articles written about this sort of thing. But I don't think they see any sort of benefit into talking much about it. They said, okay, we're going to do it, and then it's done. And, you know, we don't have to make it a thing. We don't want to make heels of the people who aren't doing it or anything like that. That doesn't serve the league in any sort of tangible way. They're not going to gain fans or clicks or money or anything like that. So I just think they kind of said, we're going to do it, and then let's hope it doesn't come up again. Now, if I was a guy who did not wear one and I was just concerned about how that would look, you know, say I have my reasons and, you know, you're entitled to whatever your reasons may be. I don't think everyone who didn't wear it is coming from the same place in their opinion on why they didn't want to wear it. I think everybody brings something to the table. And conversely, everybody who did wear it probably isn't feeling the same thing either. That being said, if I was someone who didn't wear it and I was concerned about how it would look, because I do think there is an inherent message, whether you like it or not, that people are feeling projected when you are an exception in such a thing. I would personally be interested in sitting down and telling people where I come from. You know, if I'm worried about being portrayed in a fashion that is not true to me, because I would not want that stench on me. You know, like if I don't want to wear it for X, Y, and Z reasons, but you see it as something way different than that, I would be like, let me get in front of this and clear this up, because I don't want you thinking those things about me. I would, if I'm concerned and I understand that people do feel some kind of way about that, I would be interested in talking to, you know, people in charge. You know, go talk to some of the higher ups in the league, right? Say, hey, listen, I didn't want to project something here, but I'm getting a bad look, or I have a feeling there's going to be a bad look waiting for me because I didn't feel like doing it or whatever. Then I'm sure they could put some sort of avenue together for you. Or you could talk to some of the people who are wearing it and say, okay, look, I'm clearly coming from a different place than you. You know, I will say some of the commenters said, oh, well, I'm not wearing that because that organization is. And then they talked about the organization itself that, you know, like, you know, the president of Black Lives Matter organization, you know, yeah, is embezzling money or something like that. And I assure you, people wearing a patch that says, you know, BLM, Black Lives Matter, they're not all saying BlackLivesMatter.org or whatnot. They're literally saying that Black Lives do indeed matter. If you want to mentally separate the notion of Black Lives mattering from the organization, that's on you, and you have to understand that that's not really how a lot of people wearing those patches view things. They are supporting the notion of equality and elimination of systemic oppression and things like that. So if you think that it's different, okay, but you might want to talk to some people who don't, because you might get kind of pinned into a corner that maybe you feel you don't deserve to be pinned into. So PR standpoint, if it concerns you, I would want to make some sort of note to speak up on that. At your leisure, with whomever you're comfortable discussing it with.
Right. And I think, you know, one of the other important points about this is, you know, they don't necessarily owe that to anyone.
No.
You know, they don't. And that's not what we're saying. That's not what I'm saying. It's not what Chris is saying. It's my whole thing looking at this is we owe you, right? Like, we cover this. We care about this. It's not about a leaning or an agenda, right? It's a human rights issue, man. Like, I don't know how else to describe it or tell you what it means. I know that's what it means to me. I know that it means something more and something different to other people. But this is not a gotcha, right? That's not the intention. So if you take it that way, you can take it however way you want. We're here. Come talk to us. We're really, really easy to find. So if you want to have a discussion, we're always open to have it. With that being said, let's move on to the recommendation of the week. Chris, I'll let you go first.
My recommendation of the week is an HBO 5-ish part documentary I've been watching called Yes. I'll Be Gone in the Dark. It is the story, for those who do not know, of a woman named Michelle McNamara, who was a diehard true crime buff who started a true crime website and ended up kind of becoming obsessed with one particular case. And I don't want to spoil anything else about it as far as, you know, how the case goes or anything like that. But sadly, she's no longer with us, but it is told through a bunch of people who know her or who knew her, including her her husband, Patton Oswalt. This talks about like a book she was working on and this case that she was chasing. And I think the story does a really good way of kind of intertwining the elements of the case with the toll that I guess just generally obsession can have on somebody, especially when it's like a dark material or something like that, or a deeply consuming material. I will say, if you're a little, I guess jumpy about that kind of a subject matter, you know, you might want to read up a little bit more about it, you know, before diving all the way in. But I thought it was very interesting to find out more about her and the case itself.
Chris, we actually talked about this on another podcast. This is the book. And for those of you, this is organic. It's not thrown in, so you can't cut this out. Chris and I did another podcast on, you know, that's sponsored by my newsletter, Lacrosity. So you can go check that out at lacrosity.substack.com. Great segue. Thank you. Nice. For the plug that you didn't even know you were making.
Not at all.
My recommendation, we're going to flip it back around. I'm going to do a food one, except it's not really food. So I am one of those weird people that drinks cold brew all year, right? And that is an expensive life. Let me tell you that life is expensive. Like, single serving at a really good place, that you're talking $6 minimum, right? We're not talking iced coffee here, okay? It's not iced coffee. Cold brew coffee, soft, smooth, no acidity. I use like a non-dairy creamer. It's delicious. I found a means to make it in my own house that is incredible. It's a glass bottle with a filter that is plastic that attaches to a rubberized top. And you put the coffee in the filter, you grind it up, coarse ground, you lock it in, and you pour water over the top. And you just leave it in your fridge for 24 hours. And it makes, legitimately, as long as the coffee you're using is good, legitimately the best cold brew that one can make. I will actually, it's so good, I'm going to tweet out the Amazon link to buy it. It's just a Japanese style cold brew, very easy to put together, very affordable. I think it's like $30, worth every penny. It's usually on sale for like 20. I will link it when we put this show up. But that is our show. It's volume two of the PLL. We are getting ready for the playoffs. Thanks for listening to the Inside the Cross Pro Lacrosse Podcast, PLL Edition Volume 2. Chris, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Twitter at ChrisRosie22 or Instagram at Chris Rosenthal.
And you can find me at TheKyleDevitt on Twitter and Instagram. Make sure that you are subscribed to the Inside the Cross podcast feed. Please review, download, and tell a friend to spread the word. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the games.